time, Burckhardt had greatly enriched the concept of genius with illustrative material in his influential Kultur der Renaissance. From different sources, this concept of genius fed the same widespread conviction that creativity was above all the manifestation of superabundant strength. Similar tendencies later led Fuchs to conception which are related to psychoanalysis. He was the first to make them fruitful for aesthetics. The eruptive and immediate elements which this conception regards as characteristics of artistic creation also dominate Fuchs's understanding of the work of art as well. Thus, it is often not more than a leap that separates a perception and judgment for Fuchs. Indeed, he thinks that the impression is not only the obvious impetuous which a spectator receives from a work, but the category of contemplation itself. This is summarized in his remark about the Ming period, whose artistic formalism he treats with critical reserve. These works ultimately and finally no longer achieve and sometimes do not even approach the impression which was produced by the great lines of the Tang period. Footnote 28, text. This is how Fuchs the writer acquires this particular and apodictic, not to say almost a rustic style. It is a style whose characteristic qualify the formulates masterfully in the Geschichte der erotischen Kunst, History of Erotic Art. Here he declares, from the correct feeling to the correct and complete deciphering of the creative forces in the work of art, there is always but a single step. Footnote 29, text. Not everyone can achieve such a style. Fuchs had to pay his price for it. In a word, the price was that gift of creating wonder, Staunen, which the Reiter failed to achieve. There is no doubt that he felt this lack. He tried to compensate for it in the most various ways. Thus, he liked nothing better than to speak of the secrets which he searches out in the psychology of creation, or of the riddles in the course of history which find their solution in materialism. Yet the impulse to immediately master matters at hand, an impulse which already had determined his conception of creativity as well as his understanding of reception, finally comes to dominate his analysis. The course of the history of art appears necessary. The characteristics of style appear organic, and even the most peculiar art products appear logical. One gets the impression that in the development of his analysis, these terms begin to occur less frequently than they seem to have at first. In the work of the Tang period, he still says of the fairy creatures in the painting of that time that they seemed absolutely logical and organic, with their horns and flaming wings. Even the huge elephant's ears have logical effects, and their posture, too, is always logical. Page 240. Never are they merely contrived concepts, for it is always the idea which has become a life-breathing form. Footnote 30. Text. In these formulae, a series of conceptualizations come to the fore, which are intimately connected with the social democratic doctrines of the epoch. The deep effect of Darwinism on the development of the socialist understanding of history is well known. During the time of Bismarck's persecution of the socialist, the Darwinian influence served to maintain the party's faith and determination in the struggle. Later in revisionism, the evolutionary view of history burdened the concept of development. All the more, the less the party was willing to risk what it had gained in the struggle against capitalism. History assumed deterministic traits. The victory of the party was inevitable. Fuchs always remained distant from revisionism. His political instincts and his martial nature led him to the left wing. As a theoretician, however, he was not able to remain free from those influences. One can feel them at work everywhere. At that time, a man like Ferry not only traced the principles of social democracy, but also its tactics back to natural laws. Deficiencies in the knowledge of geology and biology were held to be responsible for anarchistic deviations. Certainly, leaders like Kautsky fought against such deviations. Footnote 31, text. Nevertheless, many were satisfied with these theses which sorted historical processes into psychological and pathological ones. Or they thought that natural scientific materialism automatically turned into historical materialism simply by being in the hands of the proletariat. Footnote 32, text. Similarly, Fuchs sees the progress of human society as a process which cannot be held back, just as it is impossible to arrest the continuous forward motion of a glacier. Footnote 33, text. Consequently, deterministic understanding pairs itself with solid optimism. Yet, without confidence, no class could, in the long run, hope to enter the political sphere with any kind of success. But it makes a difference between this optimism directs itself towards the active strength of the class or whether it centers on the conditions under which the class operates. Social democracy leaned toward the latter, questionable kind of optimism. The epigones of the turn of the century were barred from a vision of the emerging barbarism which an Engels perceived in the condition of the working class in England, which a Marx glimpsed in his prognosis of capitalist development, and which is today well known even to the most mediocre statesmen. When Condorcet published The Doctrine of Progress, the bourgeoisie stood before the assumption of power. A century later, the proletariat found itself in a different position. For the proletariat, this doctrine could awaken illusions. Page 241. Indeed, these allusions provide the background occasionally revealed in Fuchs's History of Art. Today's art, he thinks, has brought us 100 fulfillments which in the most diverse directions exceed the achievements of Renaissance art, and the art of the future must certainly mean something still higher. Footnote 34, text. The pathos which runs through Fuchs's understanding of history is the democratic pathos of 1830. Its echo was the speaker Victor Hugo. The echo of that echo are the books in which the speaker Hugo addresses himself to posterity. Fuchs's conception of history is the same as that which Hugo celebrates in William Shakespeare. Progress is the stride of God himself, and universal suffrage appears as the world chronometer which measures the speed of these strides with the statement, qui vode regne. Hugo had erected the tablets of democratic optimism. Even much later, this optimism produced strange daydreams. One of these dreams produced the illusion that all intellectual workers, including persons of high material as well as social position, had to be considered proletarians. For it is an undeniable fact that all persons who hire out their services for money are helpless victims of capitalism. From a Hofrat strutting in his gold-covered uniform down to the most downtrodden piece worker. Footnote 35, text. The tablets set up by Hugo still cast their shadow over Fuchs's work. Fuchs remains with the democratic tradition when he attaches himself to France with a particular love. He admires France as the soil of three great revolutions, as the home of the exiles, as the source of utopian socialism, as the fatherland of haters of tyranny, such as Michelet and Quinet, and finally as the soil in which the communards are buried. Thus lived the image of France in Marx and Engels. Thus it descended to Mehring, and even to Fuchs. It still appeared as the land of the avant-garde of culture and freedom. Footnote 36, text. He compares the spirited mockery of the French with the clumsy ridicule of the Germans. He compares Heine with those who remained at home. He compares German naturalism with the satirical novels of Anatole France. In this manner, like Mehring, he was led to solid prognosis, especially in the case of Gerhard Hauptmann. Footnote 37. Text. France is a home for Fuchs, the collector, as well. The figure of the collector, more attractive the longer one observes it, has not been given its due attention so far. One would imagine no figure more tempting to the romantic storytellers. The type is motivated by dangerous, though domesticated, passions. Yet one searches in vain among the figures of a Hoffmann, Quincy, or Nerval for that of the collector.
Page 242.
Romantic figures are those of the traveler, of the flaneur, of the gambler, or of the virtuoso. That of the collector is not found here. In vain one searches through the physiologies, which otherwise do not miss a single figure of the Paris waxworks under Louis Philippe, from the kiosk operator to the salon lion. All the more important, therefore, is the place of the collector in the work of Balzac. Balzac erected a monument to the figure of the collector, yet he treated it quite unromantically. Balzac was always alien to romanticism anyway. There are also few pieces in his corpus in which an anti-romantic position so surprisingly claims its right as in the sketch of Cousin Pon. One element is particularly characteristic. As accurately as we know, the inventory of the collection to which Pon dedicates his life, just as little do we learn about the history of acquisition of this collection. No passage in Cousin Pon can be compared to the breathtaking suspense of the description of the uncovering of a rare find which the brothers Concord give in their diaries. Balzac does not represent the hunter in the hunting grounds of inventory as any collector might be considered. Every fiber of his pawn, of his elimagus, trembles with exultation. This exultation is the pride in the incomparable treasures which they protect with never tiring care. Balzac places all his stress on the representation of the possessor, and the term millionaire seems to him a synonym for the word collector. He speaks of Paris. There one can often meet a very shabbily dressed pawn or an illy magus. They seem neither to respect nor to care for anything. They pay attention neither to women nor to window displays. They walk along in a dream. Their pockets are empty. Their gaze is aimless. And one wonders what kind of Parisian they really are. These people are millionaires. They are collectors, the most passionate people in the world. Footnote 38, text. The image of the collector sketched by Balzac comes closer to the activity and fullness of Fuchs's character than one would expect from a romantic. Indeed, pointing to the man's life's nerve, one might say that as a collector, Fuchs is truly Balzacian, a Balzacian figure that outgrew the poet's conception. What could be more in accord with this conception that a collector whose pride in expansiveness led him to bring reproduction of his collection onto the market for the sole reason of being able to appear in public with his collections? That in consequence he becomes a rich man is again a Balzacian turn.